The Brewers of Hyde Park True Lager, the beer that's extra aged by Father Time, present Johnny Neblett in a dramatic presentation of So the Story Goes.
Tonight, you'll hear the story of the positive proof that Californians can claim to be New Englanders. You'll also hear a story in which you can't exactly figure out who was to blame.
Yes, here he is, Hyde Park's own Johnny Neblett. And so the story goes.
On a sunny June morning more than 350 years ago, a silent band of Indians gathered on the shore of a small bay near what we now call the Golden Gate. Silently, they looked out over the blue Pacific, for on the ocean was a strange sight. Before their puzzled eyes, a 66-foot English ship, her sails ragged and dirty and her hull battered, was dropping anchor just offshore. Along the rail, the ragged, bearded faces of the English crew stared in surprise at the painted savages on the beach. They had never before seen these primitive inhabitants of the North American continent, nor had the Indians ever seen the white man or the white man's sailing vessels. The two groups exchanged curious glances, and the captain of the British vessel wisely waited for the natives to make the first move before he attempted to land his men. In a moment, a bark canoe shot out from the beach. A tall, bronzed warrior paddled swiftly and silently to the side of the ship now riding at anchor. With great dignity, he stepped aboard and in his strange language made a lengthy speech. Though the Englishmen could not understand what he said, they knew by his tones and by his gestures that his was a friendly message. When the oration was over, the Indian presented to the captain a bunch of brightly colored feathers neatly gathered on a string. Gravely, the captain accepted the odd gift, and in exchange bestowed on the Indian a high silk hat. With a bow, the unsmiling Indian returned to his canoe and struck out for shore. In a few minutes, a whole fleet of wooden canoes filled the bay, their dripping paddles flashing in the sun as they headed for the English vessel. The tall silk hat had cemented a bond of friendship between the red man and the white. When the canoes returned to the beach, they brought back both their Indian owners and the Indians' newfound friends. Yes, the bearded pale faces from beyond the horizon. That night, in the light of the orange flames of huge campfires, the Indians, their faces and bodies streaked with bright daubs of paint, leaped and danced, chanting weird songs. And it soon dawned upon the English captain that the savages looked upon the white-faced men as gods. When the songs and dancing were over, the Indian chief placed a wreath of feathers on the English captain's head, crowning him king. As king, his first official act was to plant on the beach the English flag, claiming the territory for the British crown. He also had a plaque of brass made, a brass plate which the king captain nailed firmly to a heavy post. As the Indians watched silently, curiously, he stepped back a few feet and read aloud the inscription.
Be it known unto all men by these presents, June 17, 1579. For the grace of God, and in the name of Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth of England, and her successors forever, I take possession of this king, whose king and people freely resigned their right and title in the whole land, unto Her Majesty's keeping. Now named by me to be known unto all men as New England. Signed, Francis Drake.
Yes, the man who was crowned king and who claimed the territory of California for the British crown under the name New England was Francis Drake, afterwards Sir Francis Drake, the first Englishman to circumnavigate the globe. For a month, Drake and his men stayed on in New England, repairing their battered ship and stowing fresh provisions aboard her. And then on July 23rd, Drake's flagship, the Golden Hind, returned to her perilous journey. As Drake stood at the rail, waving farewell to the Indians on the receding shoreline, he saw the British flag fluttering in the breeze and the sun's rays gleaming on a shiny brass plate below the Union Jack. That was the last any white man saw of that famous brass plate for over 350 years. When Drake returned to England, he often spoke and wrote of the New England he had claimed for the crown, but it's one thing to claim a territory and another to colonize and hold it. For over three centuries, there was some doubt that Drake had ever touched our Pacific coast in his epoch-making voyage around the world. For there was no positive proof, The brass plate had completely disappeared, if there ever had been a brass plate. Skeptics pointed out that the world had only Drake's word for the details of his stay in North America. And then, only a few years ago, a boy named Beryl Shin in San Rafael, California, picked up a piece of old metal on a cliff about 500 feet from the ocean. A piece of brass he intended to use to repair a hole in his car. But when he scrubbed off the dirt that encrusted it, he saw lettering and the name Drake. Puzzled, he took it to Professor H.E. Bolton at the University of California, who pronounced it the genuine Drake brass plate. It is now the state of California's choice archaeological treasure, housed in the library of the University at Berkeley. And so the story goes, this true story of the positive proof that Californians can claim to be New Englanders.
Say, Johnny, the finding of that brass plate is like so many things that happen every day to all of us.
Well, how's that, Charlie?
Well, isn't it true that you often try something quite by chance and then discover that it really is something special? For instance, you might ask for Hyde Park beer because you were merely thirsty. But after you'd tasted Hyde Park, you'd discover that it had a zestful, delicious flavor. And if you were curious enough to ask, you'd find that the secret of Hyde Park's snap and zest is that it's naturally carbonated. And you discover, too, that Hyde Park's flavor is golden mellow and smooth. And the reason for that smoothness and mellowness is that Hyde Park is extra aged. Yes, Hyde Park is aged, and then extra aged by Father Time himself to give you extra flavor. So ask for Hyde Park next time and discover for yourself that there's added pleasure in drinking Hyde Park. And by the way, if you're staying in for a quiet evening at home, be sure to have some Hyde Park within easy reach. You'll find that complete satisfaction and the velvety smooth flavor of Hyde Park go hand in hand. Or if you're going out, remember, always ask for Hyde Park, the beer that's extra aged. Now, Hyde Park brings you Johnny Neblett with his second story.
This is a funny sort of a story. It's funny because you can't exactly figure out who was to blame. Was it the Japanese newspaper editor who offered the prize, or was it the two American flyers who collected? Maybe it wasn't either. Maybe it was a third party who doesn't even come into the story. Well, we'll give you the facts, and then you can decide for yourself. Back in 1931, a cocky little Japanese newspaper editor decided that Japanese aviation needed a good kick in its stern sheets to make it aware of the tremendous importance of aviation, both as a commercial enterprise and as a means of waging war. Not that Japanese aviation was so far behind the rest of the world. Oh, no. For 10 years previous to 1931, the Japanese had concentrated much of their attention on aviation, especially military aviation. It was just that things weren't moving fast enough to satisfy this one particular newspaper editor. So the editor offered a prize of $25,000, or the equivalent in Japanese money, as a reward to the first pilot making a nonstop flight from Tokyo to America's west coast. This prize money, thought the editor, would make things happen. Well, things happened all right, but not the way the editor had expected. Three Nipponese flyers took a crack at the money, and of the three, two crashed and one was lost. Now, coincidence being what it is, it happened that at the time the Japanese flyers were killing themselves trying to get the Mizuma, two American flyers, Clyde Pangborn and his backer, Hugh Herndon Jr., were on a world-girdling junket trying to beat the record set by Post and Getty. Pangborn and Herndon had reached eastern Siberia badly off schedule. They were debating whether to go on or not when they learned about the Japanese editor and his $25,000 prize. So they set out for Tokyo. But they flew right into a mess of trouble. They had no passports, they lacked a flight permit, and to cap the climax, Herndon, with time on his hands, had ground out some artistic movie shots of a Nipponese naval base, all of which played right into the Japanese hands. They didn't want to see Americans outdo their own flyers and collect the prize. So Pangborn and Herndon were held in honorable, polite custody while three more Japanese flyers had a try at flying the Pacific. Result? Three more washouts. Finally, after legal and diplomatic difficulties had been cleared up and the Japanese couldn't find any more excuses for holding the two Americans, Pangborn and Herndon climbed into their plane and flew over 4,500 miles of open water to the good old USA, thereby winning the $25,000. The payoff came, however, when Japanese aviation in general, and Japanese pilots in particular, got the razz, not only from American newspapers, but also from their own Japanese press. Talk about losing face. The Japanese military clique was furious. Their aviation, they thought, was their whole card, and it had been tossed into their faces as ridiculously puny. Something had to be done, and they did it. They appointed a tough little thug, Lieutenant General Kenji Dohara, to build up the Japanese Air Force. Dohara decided to develop one plane that would be second to none in the world. His first attempt was a flop, although it later developed into a passable dive bomber. For his second try, he contacted the Mitsubishi Industries. From their drawing boards came the Mitsubishi S-96 and the Mitsubishi 197. Both were single-seater fighters, both lacked range, both were slow, and both were flimsy. Well, so flimsy you could knock them out of the air with a well-aimed squirt gun. Both were tried out in the war with China, wherein Japanese aviation distinguished itself by losing 1,000 planes in 3 years and slaughtering 3,000 of its own ground troops under the impression that they were Chinese. Well, now, all of that you can write off as being funny, but the Japanese aren't humorous people. They cannot be written off as fools, even though they've made some crazy mistakes. For you see, the third Mitsubishi plane that came off the drawing boards was the deadly Navy fighter 700, the fighter we've come to know as the Japanese Zero. But even the Zero didn't meet expectations, as we've discovered in many a headline. It's a formidable plane, all right, and it's caused Allied flyers a lot of headaches. But as of now, it looks like we've outclassed it with at least three planes. But that's not our story. What we'd like to know is whether there ever would have been a Zero at all if the Japanese newspaper editor hadn't offered the money, if two American flyers hadn't collected it, and if both Japanese and American papers hadn't given Japan Aviation the raspberries. Rubbish, you say? Well, cause and effect is a strange thing. And who of you can say, as it was said in that old poem, that the horseshoe nail didn't cost the king his throne? Well, that's all for now, folks, but we'll be back soon to bring you more of these true stories gleaned from the walks of life. In the meantime, this is Johnny Neblett reminding you that careless talk has all the potency of a well-aimed torpedo. It can sink a troop ship, destroying thousands of our fighting men. So, next time, think before you talk about the movements of any man or men in our armed forces. Those few heedless words of yours, if overheard by the wrong person, may be the last link in some vital chain of information the enemy is trying to get. Remember, careless talk can cost us lives.
You have just heard Johnny Neblett in another dramatic presentation of So the Story Goes. These quarter-hour visits with Johnny Neblett are presented for your enjoyment by the thousands of men and women who make and sell Hyde Park beer, the beer that's extra aged by Father Time for extra flavor. And now this is Charles Irving saying goodnight for the Hyde Park Breweries Association Incorporated of St. Louis, Missouri, makers of Hyde Park beer.